Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
I'm Chris Kuzmi.
And I'm Mary Izette.
From Forget About It. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn.
If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. This is your host, Greg Blaze. Today is our last episode of the summer season. It's been an amazing few weeks. We talked to different generations of cheesemakers and mongers, learned about mozzarella and Conte, and we learned about growing your cheesemaking business from Andy Hatch and growing your cheese retail business from Charlotte Kamen. We recapped some significant cheese events from the Cheesemonger Invitational to the American Cheese Society Conference to the announcement of the Daphne Zeppos Teaching Award. So on today's episode, I thought it'd be great to wrap up a great summer with Max McCallman, Cutting the Curd veteran and author of several iconic cheese books, including Mastering Cheese and his most recent wine and cheese pairing swatch book. Max has been a pioneer in so many facets of cheese education, from the restaurant to the classroom. How you doing today, Max?
I'm doing great. You have a good radio voice, by the way.
Thank you. So do you.
Thank you.
So you were last on the show in January 2013 with Diane Stemple. Mm-hmm. So what have you been up to since then?
Well, I separated from Artisanal, the company that I'd been with, helped shape for two decades, and left that company. Well, that's fairly recent. Before that, I had been teaching. So I was thinking about it on the way here, is that the saying is that if you can't do it, you teach it. And since I can't make cheese and choose not to, I'll teach it.
You think it's more that you choose not to that you can't do it,
well,
right?
I've made cheese, and it's just not my thing. I think I can help the industry a lot better by teaching it.
Well, I was wondering, in regards to teaching, on a previous episode, you had mentioned that teaching people cheese was healthy and nutritious was the most important thing to you.
That's the takeaway. So always, whenever I speak, give me a microphone, cheese is a near-perfect food.
Well, we got like six microphones here. I can turn most of them towards you.
Yeah.
But do you think that people have learned that lesson?
A little bit. I think that could be part of the reason why Americans are eating more cheese than ever before, and it could be one of the reasons why industry is growing globally, the appreciation, the connoisseurship. But I think we still have a long way to go. Even with the industry itself, I think there are a lot of people that still look at cheese as though it's some sort of an indulgence, like they really can't or shouldn't. And like, come on. It's like, how much cheese can you possibly eat? You know, I eat cheese like there's no tomorrow, and you know, I have a hard time keeping my weight up. for one consideration.
Well, if you take that and you think that people look at cheese as an indulgence, what's the key to get them to understand that it's a vital part of your diet and also of just the fabric of food culture in America in general, if we're not already there?
Well, you look at what the raw ingredients are, and the primary ingredient, of course, is milk, our first food and our only food for the first several weeks and months out of our lives. And we're growing faster, smarter, we're more beautiful, a lot more popular than when we start mixing in fruits and vegetables. That's when things start to go wrong.
Do you think people
it's a little risky, you know?
I think fruits and vegetables are very risky. They're a very risky business. I marginalize them in my diet and my life as much as I possibly can. I tend to replace them, we know, with alcohol and cheese.
Yes, they go hand in hand, those two, actually. That's right.
That might shorten my life, but it's exponentially, you know,
well, see, I used to be
in quality.
I used to be an alcohol guy. I used to be a wine expert. I worked as a maitre d', sommelier, and various those types of jobs in restaurants and hotels and caterers and all that. And I thought I knew a little bit about wine, but I learned a lot more when I used cheese as a platform. I also thought that I might extend my lifespan a little bit by incorporating a little cheese into my diet to balance out the wine.
Soak it up.
Soak it up. Exactly.
So you've written, I mean, like I said, I've interviewed, you know, this summer I've interviewed cheesemongers and cheesemakers, but you're a different kind of cheese guy. You know, I mean, you're an educator. I've always wanted to ask you, would you ever consider, you know, just doing it, opening up Max's, you know, Max's cheese shop or just
something like that? I think that knowing how difficult it is to make a go of it, as you well know, it's like the margins in the cheese business are very tight. Yeah, it's just, yeah, so not that I'm afraid of low margins or tight margins. It's just that I think that given my background and the way I like to, in a cheese shop you can do a lot, yes, but there are challenges, not just economic challenges. There's a lot of competition, especially right here in greater New York. In my neighborhood alone, and here in Brooklyn, it's we have like three cheese shops within a six-block radius and of my house. And they do pretty well, but I believe that what I can do or what I enjoy doing mostly is teaching, and a cheese shop doesn't really afford that opportunity unless it has its own little classroom in back. Some shops have something like that, but I like to do it on a little bit bigger scale and a broader scale. For example, I just came back from a couple of fundraisers, one at Tanglewood, the Tanglewood Wine and Food Classic, and I was invited to do a seminar there. And the hook is cheese and wine. You know, if you just say cheese, a cheese seminar, you might get a couple of people.
Yeah, you got to get people lubricated.
Right. And then the other one that I did was for raising monies for charities in Central Indiana, Mickey's Camp. And even though it doesn't pay it an honorarium, those kinds of things are, I think, important. And I meet people, and hopefully it will help to help me make a go of it with my new company, which is Max. Yeah,
your new company is just called Max.
Well, I tried to get that that name, but it was already taken, so I had to settle for Max.
I was going
to
say, are you like Max 75 or like Max 175 or whatever? Like when I lost my first email address, they made me do that. Now I'm like GWB 1054. It's interesting that you mentioned, you know, right in the top of the program that you were with Artisanal for a long period of time because I actually worked with you there.
That's right.
I wanted to get your opinions on Artisanal because, and for those of you who don't know, Artisanal was a place that I feel was a little bit ahead of its time, especially the cheese center, which was actually designed specifically to take advantage of your talents. I felt it was
and Daphne's and many others too. Yeah,
it was. I mean, it was a far-reaching project. There, I believe those were some of the. Those were some of the first maturing caves that I had heard of.
First of their kind in the U.S. Yeah. I mean, of that type. That is, types of caves where cheeses were brought in from producers, preferably on the young side, where we could cure them. By the way, you're exceptional at this, Greg. I mean, I have not seen anyone that can make cheeses happier in a cave than you.
I make cheeses happier than I make people, definitely. I'll give you that, but
yeah.
Thank you.
Cheeses are a little bit easier.
Well, I remember – yeah, they are. They can't talk back. They also – they drink less, although they do drink sometimes.
Oh, yeah. They suck it up. Yeah.
So we – when we worked there, I remember beginning with so much promise, and you know, and you are always as you have been since I've known you. You've been at the forefront of education. What's your takeaway from Artisanal, like good and bad? You know.
Well, it was a great platform for me. Before Artisanal, it was the Artisanal Bistro. Before Artisanal Bistro, it was Picholine. And Picholine was where I the first cheese cave in a restaurant in North America. I called it my office. And so that was that, I think that was the start of something big, and it was something very challenging but fun and exciting for me, and all the facets that cheese include, all the different studies made it a lifelong study for me. So advance forward from Picheline, the Artisanal Bistro, the Artisanal Cheese Center. The Artisanal Cheese Center gave me this big classroom that could seat 50 people.
Exactly.
Nice number. And so I was able to teach a master series there, which many people went through, people we both know, and that helped them get into the industry as retailers, sometimes cheese makers or restaurateurs that would have a cheese program. And so people just wanted a change of careers. I tried to talk them out of it. But the Artisanal Cheese Center did give me, I was able to continue writing. I had already written my first book, started on my second book, finished it at the Artisanal Cheese Center, started my third book.
Those were with David Gibbons, right?
With David Gibbons, exactly. And he's now the cheese writer for The Wine Spectator, by the way.
Fantastic.
And we may be collaborating on another book pretty soon, but I have to find time to write the thing. In the meantime, I'm writing for the Cheese Connoisseur and Culture Magazine and Deli Business from time to time. But the Artisanal Cheese Center, like you say, I think it was a little bit ahead of its time. And it was a little bit ahead, but it was also kind of behind in some ways.
How so?
Well, because there were already some other players that were doing online cheese business before we even opened the doors at Artisanal in 2003. We had we checked out to see what other people were doing. Fromage.com, I think, was one of them. And some of the cheese makers around the country were doing online cheese business. In 2003, can you imagine that? That was Google.
That was a ways back, and I do remember all of the disconnect between the cheese caves and getting the cheese caves. And just what Artisanal taught me, working with you, or the Cheese Center taught me, the restaurant – working at the restaurant and managing that taught me that I never wanted to work at another restaurant ever again, which I never have. Not because I disliked Artisanal Bistro. The feel of it, just the energy and the feel of it was amazing to me. It was like a three-ring circus in there back in 2003. Mm-hmm. And we had some great customers, and I had a lot of fun working there. But that was a lifestyle that for me wasn't sustainable for many reasons. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I do remember just the logistics, the nuts and bolts of getting cheese from the cheese caves and into boxes and sending them out across the country. It seemed to me like was something that was just wasn't considered there, you know, and or not that it wasn't considered, but like anything you do first, you know, you get to make all the mistakes.
Right. But it was interesting to see those packages going out to these little towns that you'd never heard of, somewhere in the Midwest.
I loved that.
People are getting their little collection of cheese of the months from Artisanal, and cheese that they'd never seen. You know, they'd never crossed the Mississippi.
Absolutely.
And it was that was cool, and I think this is part of what helped grow the appreciation here in the United States, because we did have the exposure. We did have the recognition because the Artisanal Bistro became very famous.
Absolutely, and it still is.
Cheese destination, and Picheline before it. And so, and then the books, and then my tour of duty with Disney World, which is still going on.
Talk to me about that.
Yeah, every year since 1997, I've been the maître fromager for the Epcot International Food and Wine Festival.
I think that's pretty awesome, actually.
And so it was so popular the first year, 1997.
Yeah.
They thought, we're going to have a little cheese and wine seminar with Max McCallum and Picheline. This is for the bistro. And I said, well, how many seats? And they said, well, we got 100, but we can take a few more. And I said, you might want, if you have room for more, you might want to do a full 150 plates. There was a line of people out the door completely around this building, people wanting to get in. So they decided to do it not just one weekend, but to do it every weekend at the festival. They even added a weekend this year for the first time. So there are seven sessions that I'm planning them. I'm not doing all of them. I have a couple other people that will be representing cheese on a couple other weeks.
You got to have minions in this world, Max. You got to have minions. It's there's too much to do.
There's too many
avenues to reach people now.
Yep.
I think that's one of the interesting things, because you are an educator and you have more. You just have more ways to reach people now than you did maybe back then. Would you agree?
Yeah. It's here. It's today. It's in these and any time that even you know, even if it doesn't pay, I think it's important to, is to what I call spread the curd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I took over this summer hosting the show for Anne.
Right.
And
I saw last weekend, by the way.
Yes. And yeah. we want to see her again soon. I miss Anne. And like, I think for myself, I didn't realize entirely how important that was to step outside of, say, a cheese counter, which I believe, for me, educating people is always just putting things in their mouths and making them
eat. Let the cheese speak for itself. I agree.
But there's, like you said, there's so many people and there's so much information out there now that it becomes disinformation after a time if you don't hit all of the mediums, you know,
right,
with the correct information.
Exactly.
And so your new company, is that going to – are you going to focus
so
on that?
I hope so. We have a new venue we found in Chelsea, and it's a beautiful gallery with a home above it, and there is a space to do the most popular class that I ever taught was a Cheese and Wine 101. I'm not going to call it that, but it's not going to be a class so much as an event. I want it to be a little less pedantic, not sitting in front of a, you know, classroom situation. I want it to be a little entertaining. Infotainment is what I envision. I think that the experience is what people would like, and also superior quality of wines than what I've used in the past.
That's the thing too. As I've been lucky enough to teach some courses to people,
yep.
I think it's it is a class, but I don't sell it to them that way. I always tell them it's a tasting
mm-hmm.
because then they some people like myself have less than fond memories of school. So when I think of a classroom setting, I always think of like somebody yelling at me for kind of screwing off.
I'm going to do some yelling during my master. the 2-day course that I'm putting on the calendar, hopefully within a week. This is something that it'll be a 2-day class, condensing everything, all the facets of cheese, into a couple of days with an optional side trip to a dairy nearby.
Oh, that's fantastic. People love field trips.
Yep.
So when you say you're going to teach people,
I will be yelling at people. I will be testing
cheese.
Them. Right.
What does that entail? You're going to teach them the cheese making process all the way up to how they should put it in their mouths?
Seasonality, the aesthetics, regulations, updates and regulations, which are always,
especially
always
these days.
Yeah, with the Food Safety Modernization Act, we have to be on our toes. And so if someone's considering going into the cheese business from any angle, I'm going to try to cover it and hopefully help prepare people for any cheese exam they may have in their future.
Yeah, we want to talk about that. We're going to have to take a short break here on Cutting the Curd, but we're here with Max McCallman, cheese enthusiast, and we'll be right back. Thanks so much.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome back. We're here with Max McCallman on this, our final episode of the summer here in 2014. Right before the break, Max made mention of possible exams in the future
mm-hmm.
That people may have to take to prove their cheese mettle as professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the cheese certified cheese professional exam.
As endorsed by the American Cheese Society.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you are the proctor of that exam, are you not?
I'm the chair of the committee.
Cool.
I'm one of the founders of the effort, and one of the early members of the effort was Daphne.
Daphne Zeppels.
She was a member of our committee, too. And so I have one more year as chairman, and then I may do something else. But I think that it's onto a good track. We had 220, I think, plus people sit for the exam in Sacramento. and at least 2/3 of them passed.
That's fantastic. Like that. Yeah. That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, in one of your earlier appearances, right before Raleigh, which I believe was the initial exam, you had spoken of it. So is that going the way that you want it to go? Do you think it's making a really big impact?
Huge, huge. I think it's helping the industry. These will be long-term benefits coming out of this because whether people pass or not, they're studying for it. And so it's a lot of young geeks out there that want to know this stuff. And they're becoming more erudite about all these different angles of cheese, like why it's important and what's in it and how it's made. And because, you know, behind a counter, sometimes I like to walk into a cheese shop just to see what they're saying.
Yeah, of course.
And I'd have to bite my tongue, you know, because some of the information that's given out, especially with regard to safety, raw milk, you know, the.
What do you hear?
Well, like, it's okay to eat raw milk cheese. Don't worry about it. Or, you know,
it's okay, but isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's more okay than pasteurized cheese, in my opinion.
Right.
Those are the ones that go south faster. Those compromised milk cheeses. But but I think it's not a cheesemonger's. It's not something that a cheesemonger should be saying. You know, you're not the obstetrician. You know, you can.
That's what I always tell people behind the counter, is that I'm not a doctor.
Right.
But by the same token, you know, this is interesting because there's no set way I've found in all the counters that I've worked at to address the customers, you know? So I think that people should just give out as little information as possible and just make the sale.
On that topic?
On any topic, unless, you know, you've got cheeses.
Right,
they
right.
have signage, generally,
yeah,
prices
yeah.
per pound. You've right. got to know the origin of the milk, whether or not the milk has been pasteurized. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
You should know roughly how old the cheese is.
Right.
And you should be able to give a description of the flavor profiles.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's a standard that should be in any service industry. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You don't walk into a bar and ask a bartender, they've got 10 beers on tap, and have them say, you know, what does this beer taste like? You mm-hmm. know, and they'd say, I don't know. I don't drink beer. You know?
Well, you know, but to that point, it's the Socratic method is what got me started at Picholine years ago. People would say, well, how does this compare to a Saint-Marcellin?
Right.
And I'd never had a real one, so I couldn't really say. And this person was well-traveled. They'd been to Provence, and they knew what they were talking about. And so it behooved me to become a little more expert about it. And so asking questions like that, which you get at a counter, too, people say, well, is this less fattening than this cheese or something? You know, it's all,
right.
all that sort of stuff. And so I think that's why the CCP endeavor is valuable, because for the cheesemaker, which is what the ACS is mostly for and about, the cheesemaker should be have a level of comfort
selling their product to the cheesemonger.
To the CCP,
yeah.
You know, the one that's been that's shown that he or she has some mastery of the product.
And you're teaching all three levels. You're teaching the cheese. You got cheesemakers coming to you. You got cheesemongers coming to you, and customers coming to you.
And enthusiasts, yeah.
That's far-reaching. That's pretty awesome. So, like I said earlier, I talked to cheesemongers, cheesemakers.
Mm-hmm.
But you're a restaurant guy, and I often wondered.
It's in my blood, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. It's. And the access, the restaurant access, is so much different than the retail access.
Right.
Your interface with the products, your interface with the customers, is much
more involved.
You
see that immediate, feedback and
you do.
Gratification. And even more. I mean, even if you give a sample out at a retail environment, that's one thing. But to
the
be
context
able to sit down,
is different.
Right. Right.
Completely different.
Right.
But you know, so you ran this, like, you know, the flagship cheese cart in America, in Picholine, definitely, and a place that inspired a whole ton of other people to try the same thing and shed light maybe on some older folks who had been throwing the cheese plate out there at the end of the meal, you know, in French restaurants around America. So, you know, you see all of these new cheesemongers, new cheesemakers, more people at the ACS, more people taking the CCP. So what's up with the restaurant cheese cart? Where's that at right now?
Well, I wish it was a little bit farther along. And you see little places here and there where it's happening, but it should be more, I think. And it's not a trend. Now, cheese is not a trend. I mean, the upward growth in per capita consumption here is very impressive. We have a long way to go to get to the top 10 consumers, but we're on our way. And I think the restaurant is a good vehicle for doing that. But I think that a lot of restaurateurs are afraid of it.
Why so?
I think they think that they look at it as it's not going to make the margins that they can make on creme brulee.
But it sells more booze, though, which is
exactly
the point.
And when we opened, when we launched our cheese program at Picholine in late 1994, before the cheese service, the check average was $85. 6 months after we launched the cheese program, the check average was $135.
Yeah, that's
and that's
going to make everybody happy.
Exactly, and so. Part of that, only a fraction of that, is the cheese. The bigger percentage is the booze. But another reason why the check average went up, it was because of the appreciation. So the restaurant was able to raise their prices across the board because of the cheese. It became a cheese destination. If you wanted to go there, you had to pay. And so, you know.
I like that idea. I mean, I've worked at places where margins are extremely high, but it's the quality that you're paying for.
Right. By the way, you don't take margins to the bank.
And no, just, or percentages.
Or percentages.
I learned that lesson from Giorgio De Luca and when I first managed.
Good for him.
You know.
Good for him.
But
some people are so stuck on those percentages that that the business is doomed to failure, because that's not what you take money to the bank. You take cash to the bank, be it a margin of 30% or 70%.
I wish, like you said. So you wish that the cheese card or the restaurant cheese scene was moved a little forward. Why do you think it's bogged down? You said people are afraid of it. The restaurateur is afraid of it.
I think that sometimes, for example, at Picholine, one concern was if the people sit for a cheese course, they might tie up a table for an extra 20 minutes, because the cheese is something you
linger over it
a little bit. Yeah, at least. But I remember this one occasion where a party of four, they were having they wanted a little bit of cheese, and we had people waiting for the table. It was during those high-flying times in the late 1990s. And so
those were high-flying times.
They were. And so the party said, "We just like a little bit of cheese." And I'm thinking, oh, well, okay, here's $15 worth of cheese, three cheese for you to share. Maybe you'll be out in less than 20 minutes so we can turn the table and make some more money for the restaurant. And then the host says, "So what would you pair with this plate of cheese?" And I said, "Looks like Chateau de Kim to me."
Uh-huh.
"And for $495, you can keep that table for an extra 20 minutes." So $15 cool. for the cheese and $4.95 for the booze.
That's pretty sweet. I always when I worked at Artisanal, they were always concerned about the turn, but Artisanal had a different method of selling cheese plates. You had some people who had asked for I was loosely in control when I ran the bistro counter, but I would get these crazy people who wanted 20 cheese plate arrangements. You know what I mean? And and they were there for basically another whole meal at the end.
That brings up the other point, and that's the cost of labor. Because to do that, you don't just create 20 plates of cheese, just on the get-go. It's something that takes time. It's time-consuming. So the cost of the labor of running a cheese program, I think it's justified ultimately, but it's a little hard to swallow when you just look at just the labor and the cost of the cheese. So
I always thought, too, that it was hard for people in the restaurant industry to take proper care of the cheese. Like in the kitchen, I thought it got banged around a little bit, and it was delicate.
Definitely in the kitchen, yeah, and I think that someone should own the cheese course.
There's a question I wanted to ask you. Do you think that in the future, in your new incarnation, that you would ever be willing to do a CCP or a restaurant program to teach those guys?
Well,
how
that's
to take
what
care?
That's part of that's a good part of what I'm offering in this new mastering cheese class. It is a class. That is a more academic, and there is definitely the consideration not only for the restaurant course service background, but also for someone approaching it from another angle.
But is it? Do you see the cause and effect? Do you know what I mean? The physical cause and effect of storing cheese and handling cheese a certain way is something that I've always felt that.
Well, there are many ways you can make sure that that's manageable.
How so?
Well, the selection of cheese to begin with. And another thing is
choosing sturdy cheese.
Sturdy cheese is helpful, but I also recommend that with buying cheese that you buy less, but you buy often, as you probably have too. You don't buy your cheese you're going to have for 2 weeks from today. You don't stock up. This is not that kind of experience. Instead, you buy what you're going to, like the way you buy fish. And one of our friends, Jason Donnelly, that's one of his lines, too. It's like, you know, buy what you're going to have.
And it changes a culture in the restaurant industry. I mean, but, you know, chefs, I deal with some chefs, they come to the counter at Eataly, or pastry chefs mostly are the people that I find that are handling the cheese course. But
and
I get
right
very
out of
few
cold
of
storage.
Them. Yeah, or they just don't get around to coming to see you as much as they can.
Right.
So I always thought it would be interesting to create a program for restaurants. Well, that somehow that pull them in to force them to come to the retail counter.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, and you know, I mean, people would say, oh, obviously, that's just called a wholesale discount. But I don't really think I don't think they care. Care for the discount, or I don't think the discount it trumps the fact that they don't have the time to come and get it done. Well, as a final question, you know, I wanted to ask you. You know, I said I had Andy Hatch on, and you talked about purchasing the Uplands dairy, and Charlotte Kamen on, and she's growing the Bedford Cheese Shop, and then cheesemakers as well. And you you mentioned that you were gonna not rebrand yourself because you're an iconic brand. You're a Max brand. But what would you offer as advice to yourself or to others for people who wanted to grow their brand as a cheese professional?
Hire me. because it's not just me. It's there are quite a few players that I am involving, because I don't know it all, and I don't have all these talents, but I do know a lot of people. I have a big Rolodex, so to speak, and I think that what I can do is help people make decisions, help them develop their business plans and strategize with them, and then help them make a success out of it. People want my job, but it's not for sale.
That's pretty awesome.
I do have I can offer a lot of insights and help, but I don't know. This is a unique position. It's hard that I have here in the industry. It's something that I enjoy, I've had a lot of fun with it, and it is work, but I love every day of it.
Of course you do. It sounds like you're back on the pioneering trail, which is kind of where you've always been.
Yeah, you asked about artisanal. One of the things I felt like I was not able to be as creative in the last few years with artisanal as I was at the beginning when I helped develop the mission statement. And one of the problems with artisanal is that the original blueprint for the artisanal cheese center where we worked, you and I worked, I thought there was a lot of room for offices, but not nearly enough room for cheese.
As a person who worked there, I couldn't agree with you more.
The production area was it was like a walk-in closet compared to all these spacious offices all around the perimeter. And it was supposed to be about cheese, but instead it was about offices.
Well, I'm sure that your new endeavor will be all about cheese. If people wanted to get in touch with you, find out more about what you got going on, how would they go about doing that?
I'd say the first thing is just to, if you want to email info@max-mccalman.com, or you can just visit the website. And the website's it's been up for a few weeks, and we're still tweaking it, but it's looking pretty good. A lot of information there.
Got the new website.
And, or read my articles, too.
Hey, you have a couple of things you mentioned. You said you just wrote an article for Cheese Connoisseur.
I've written several articles for them over the past couple of years, actually, and I have one on the wooden board issue, and I think it was very fair on the wooden board issue. Oh, by the way, ACS, I'm sure you mentioned the FDA paid us a visit.
Absolutely. What did you think about that, actually?
I thought it was great. It looks like, not that I fully trust them, but I felt like it was a collaborative effort in the making, and so it looks positive.
I think that something that people forget is that these people aren't going away. So I ran into people at the ACS, and I run into people who want to rail against the FDA as an evil body, but it's like kind of tough, you know, shit for you, because they're not going anywhere. Do you know what I mean? So you either adapt or not, you know? And what I took away from that was not so much that the FDA is this like heinous, crazy, evil thing. It's just more like, these are people who don't know exactly what it is they're legislating against all the time.
And this is the ACS is doing a very good job of trying to be vigilant and also being proactive. And I think instead of putting up a fight, they know better. And it's a smartly run organization. I think the CCP program is going to help with this collaboration, because when an inspector comes around, you better not have anything to hide, obviously. And what you're trying to do is show that you know what you're talking about, and you can show that you're using, you have a good HACCP program plan and all that.
As a person who's been through hundreds of Board of Health inspections as a retailer,
aren't they fun?
The thing is, my father was a Board of Health inspector for 30
oh, really?
Years, so I know what's about. If you're clean and you're diligent about your practices, you're gonna come off well with the inspectors. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
People operate, I think, a lot more on common sense than they're given credit for. If you walk in and your cheese making area isn't clean, mm-hmm. then they're gonna start looking into it. But if everything looks in order and it is clean, mm-hmm. I feel like you just will get less hassle. And a lot of those times, inspectors are done on a state level. You don't have the head of the FDA coming to inspect your plant
right.
on a regular basis. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
And I feel like a lot of those things are also about personal relationships.
Yep.
Because a lot of inspectors that I dealt with didn't know what the cheese was about, but after I conversed with them and they saw that I was conscientious in keeping my area clean,
mm-hmm.
they were a lot more willing to work with me.
Yeah, and it's also good. It is good, not just clean, but it's also good to have documentation.
Yeah.
They like to see records. They like to see a lot of paper.
Which is probably why I'm not a cheesemaker, because I don't write anything down.
No.
I can't do it. Well, Max, I just wanted to say thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks for inviting me.
You got the anchor position. Thanks for listening to another episode of Cutting the Curd. Especially thanks to Jack Inslee, the engineer, the maestro, unseen protector of Cutting the Curd and all the shows here. So you guys tune in for new episodes in a couple of weeks. We'll be back with more. Take care.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.